All right, let's go ahead and get started. Thanks for coming to the Kennedy Center Stats and Methodology Core Training Series. My name is Julie Lons-Taylor, and I'm the Education Director. Just a few quick points. If you're not on our email list and you want to get emails about upcoming seminars or workshops that we're having, there's a sign-up sheet in the back that you can sign up on. And I also wanted to mention that our next seminar is going to be on January 27th, and it's going to be Tony Brown talking about missing data. So you might want to mark that on your calendars because it's something we all deal with, I think. So our speaker today is Dr. Andrew Tamarkin, who is Associate Professor of Psychology and Biostatistics and Chair of the Psychology Department here at Vanderbilt. Right now, his primary interests include quantitative methods with an emphasis on generalized linear models, structural equation modeling, and analysis of repeated measures data. And he's going to be talking today about potential problems and ambiguities associated with well-fitting structural equations.
Am I on?
Thanks.
Okay. If I start on fire, you'll put it out. Hi, I'm Andy Tamarkin, and my expectation is that this is a pretty diverse audience in terms of experience with structural equation modeling. I'm sure there's a number of you out there who have, you know, maybe taken a class in SEM, run analyses using SEM and done so over the past several years. And then on the other hand, there might be people who, you know, are pretty new to it and really just pretty much novices. So what I'm going to do is try to take the middle road here and try to, at various points, appeal to both constituencies. The overriding focus of today's paper, or today's talk, is this. Several years ago, Niels Waller, who used to be here, and I, wrote a couple of papers on SEM that were kind of general reviews of the literature, both the methodological literature and how SEM was used by applied researchers. And one of the things that struck us was the very, very strong emphasis on whether a model fits. It's a good thing to emphasize. It's an important thing. But two additional points, an emphasis on model fit to the exclusion of other considerations. And in addition, a failure to note that a model can fit well according to specific criteria, but have very significant problems that are kind of subtle and yet foundational problems in another sense. And so that was kind of the motivating stimulus behind the two papers we wrote. And that's, in a lot of ways, what today's talk is about. So what I'd like to do is start off by just briefly introducing structural equation modeling and really kind of emphasize this whole core concept of model fit. And then the major bulk of the talk will be reviewing several ambiguities and problems that are associated with well-fitting models, even models that fit well according to consensual criteria. But problems and ambiguities that are typically ignored by users. The overriding take-home message here is a little broader than just SEM. It's that it's very important for users of statistical procedures to bear in mind what precisely is being tested and assessed when you're assessing model fit. Very often it's something highly specific that is being assessed, and it may not be what you think it is. And also that, as a result, you need to look beyond omnibus measures of model fit. Now, this is something that you've learned in other contexts, actually. So if you take an analysis of variance class, hopefully the person teaching at some point has told you not to be place undue emphasis on the overall ANOVA F test, but to put an emphasis on planned comparisons. Specific aspects of the data. It's the same kind of message as that. Okay, what is structural equation modeling? Now, this is a difficult thing to define something as complicated as structural equation modeling, but I'm going to try to kind of break it down to its essentials. It's basically a method for estimating and testing models that really are hypothesized to account for the variances and covariances, and in some cases means, but we're just going to stick with variances and covariances. Among a set of variables. And Special equation models typically consist of sets of linear equations containing a variety of parameters. And very often the parameters of most interest are what are known as free parameters, which are parameters that have to be estimated by a numerical routine. And the thing about special equation modeling, in some ways, it's really very noteworthy, is two types of linear relationships can be specified. One is between latent constructs, what you might consider to be factors, really, in kind of a factor analytic sense, and their observable indicators. Okay? And we'll see some examples of this as we go along. And the other kind of relationship is the relationship among the latent constructs themselves. So the first kind of relationship between indicators and factors often is called the measurement model. The relationship between constructs is often called the structural model. So actually kind of an unfortunate term, given that it is structural equation modeling, but that's just the lingo as it's developed. Now, one way you can think about this sort of thing is it kind of combines an emphasis for many, many years. It's been there on econometrics for simultaneous equation models with the emphasis from psychology, education, and psychometrics on factor analysis. It really is a combination of those two. Now, I think structural equation modeling has a lot of advantages, and let me just note some of them. First of all, it forces researchers to be really explicit, to specify a model with a high level of detail, more detail than you would typically use in other contexts. Second thing is it typically aligns the null hypothesis with the research hypothesis. You may have noted that when you do a between group t-test and you're testing the null hypothesis that two groups' means do not differ, you're actually doing the study because you think they will differ. So that there's an asymmetry between the statistical hypothesis being tested and the research hypothesis. Now, in structural equation modeling, actually the research hypothesis being tested can be the statistical hypothesis and commonly is, and I think that's a good thing. In principle, it allows for separate assessments of relationships between observable indicators and latent variables on the one hand and among the latent variables themselves on the other hand. And this is a good thing. Any of you have ever read Krombeck and Meehl's classic paper on construct validity, you know this is a kind of fundamental issue that is difficult to actually resolve in other contexts. These days, SEM can be used to test models that are really, in some ways, impossible to test with other procedures, or at least test well. And one big selling point of SEM is that it does allow you to test the overall fit of a model. And that's actually the focus of today's talk. Let me try to give you kind of a feeling, those of you who are not really very familiar with SEM models, give you kind of a feeling for some representative types of models. Now, one of the things about SEM that is really an acquired skill and that actually takes a while to develop, is the ability to turn a figure into a set of equations. And I really believe, although this is not talked about that much in books on SEM, this is part of the learning curve of SEM. SEM is very graphics-based in terms of the depiction of models and also, like these days, in terms of the software implementation of models. So here's a path analysis model that a guy named Don Lyman, published several years ago. And the idea here is to try to develop a causal model predicting impulsivity and delinquency. You'll note here, just to familiarize yourself with some of the syntax, the distal predictors here are SES, test effort, and verbal IQ scores. These double-edged arrows here just mean that we specify that these three variables are correlated with one another. No causal relationship is being specified here. So these just indicate correlations. The directed arrows here indicate hypothesized causal relationships. So this model, for instance, with regard to SES, is proposing that there's a direct effect on there's an effect on impulsivity, a direct effect on delinquency, and also an indirect effect on delinquency that's mediated through the AE pathway via impulsivity. Okay. Also you see here little E1 and E2 circles here. Circles or ovals in SEM land denote latent variables. In this case, these are residual terms. I mean, there's nothing more latent and unobservable than error. So I think that will fit the bill here. Now, the key thing is to understand that this model translates into a set of linear equations. So here we have two equations. We actually have two dependent variables. One is impulsivity, the other is delinquency. So equation one is impulsivity equals some coefficient A times SES plus B times test effort plus C times VIQ. Similarly, there's an equation predicting delinquency. And here are the parameters A, B, C, D, and E, among others, that we want to estimate. Now, these look like regression equations. And indeed, you could solve this model with two separate multiple regression equations. We'll talk about it a little bit later. SEM offers a little bit of a different slant on that. But in many ways, that's pretty much the essence of it. Now, the wonderful thing about SEM is it's a pretty flexible sort of thing. As a matter of fact, it's probably the most overarching framework at this point for testing statistical hypotheses. And so you can test very different looking models here. And this is not a causal model. It's a confirmatory factor analysis model. It's a classic one, actually. Arguing that, and the specification is that these three measures, and observable measures are denoted by rectangles or squares, latent variables or factors are denoted by circles and ovals. Testing a model that specifies that these three measures load on a spatial factor, these three measures load on a verbal latent factor, and in addition, specifying that those factors are correlated with one another. Now, again, the key thing to understand here is that kind of a drawing into a set of linear equations, for one equation for each of the dependent variables. And using the numerical routines in SEM, what you will ultimately obtain is the actual coefficients here that you're trying to estimate. Here, there is no coefficient. It's really a fixed coefficient of 1, which is necessary to identify a model or make it testable. And I won't go into details about that. That would take us a little too far afield. And in addition, you will get out estimates of the variances of the factor and their covariances. Now, you can combine both sets of models, a path analysis model and a confirmatory factor analysis model, into a latent variable causal model. It really is a combination. This is a model that Tim Troll tested in 2001, predicting borderline features, which is probably not a place you want to get to. And from some distal parental variables and also a set of temperamental variables, the notion here is that considering, for instance, trait negative affectivity, this is a factor that has three indicators, a measure of depression, a measure of anxiety, and a measure of hostility, which are kind of classic indicators of what's known in the literature as negative affectivity. And so there's a component of this model that is assessing the relationship between these indicators and their latent variables. But in addition, there's the structural component of the model, which is assessing the relationships between the latent constructs. Okay? Now, this is just a sampling of the types of models that can be tested by SEM. I noted there's a wide variety of types of models. And my goal here is not to give you a comprehensive review of structural equation mining, but just to give you a feel for what the sorts of models are. Now, when you do a structural equation modeling analysis, what do you want to do? What's the goal here? What ultimately do you want to get out in terms of output? Well, first, you'd want to get estimates of the relevant free parameters or coefficients and estimates of their standard errors. So here's output from a computer program looking at that two-factor model and giving you estimates of the factor loadings here, their standard errors, tests of their significance. That's one thing. Second thing that is really the focus of today's talk is to assess overall fit of a model. I'll be talking a little while about what is the essence of this concept of fit, but just to note, that is something that you will be able to find out about. This is the result of the well-known chi-square test of exact fit, often criticized because it's so sensitive to sample size and variety of other limitations. And just to note, typically if you're rooting for the model, you don't want a significant significant model because you're testing the null hypothesis that the model does fit. So this would indicate that this model does fit here, given the p-value. But there are also a variety of measures of goodness of fit. Here's one, very commonly used one, the RMSEA, that actually Steiger, who's here, thought up many years ago, which gives you an index of the fit of the model. Now, a final thing you're going to want to do, or is commonly done, is to compare different models using SEM. So here's our target initial model that specifies that these spatial and verbal factors are correlated. Here's a more restricted model that specifies the absence of a correlation. And this is actually a subtle point that I'm going to talk about a little bit later, which is that oftentimes a restriction is not screaming out at you when you look at a depiction of a model. It's often something that's not there, which I actually think is a critical issue in understanding SEM models. It actually creates a lot of problems for people. But this model is actually specifying that these two factors are orthogonal, correlated zero. SEM software will typically be able to give you out a nested chi-square test, which tests the relative fit of these two models. This is significant, which would suggest that the restricted model significantly impairs the fit relative to a model that specifies that those two factors are correlated. Okay, now let me focus on the concept of model fit in SEM. Here's the question that's being addressed. Does the structure that's implied by the model account for the observed variances and covariances in the set of variables that are in the model? And we actually do a comparison here. We compare the observed covariance matrix for the data to the covariance matrix that's implied by the model. All right? Now, unfortunately, this is not an SEM class, because if it was an SEM class, we'd spend the next 3 weeks talking about how models actually imply variances and covariances. So I want you to take this on faith for the moment, and I'm going to flesh it out in a second. And the measure of fit is really tied to a measure of discrepancy, a discrepancy between the observed covariance matrix and the data and the covariance matrix that is implied by the model. And there is something known as a discrepancy function. It's typically denoted as F. This is the maximum likelihood discrepancy function. There are other estimators. And this discrepancy function appears in the formula for all conventionally used statistical tests for estimates of model fit. In other words, there's a whole buffet table of models of possible measures of fit here. But if you look hard enough in the formula, you're going to find F playing a starring role in all those measures, that measure of discrepancy. Now, here's the thing about SEM. The fitting function will try to find estimates of your parameters that meet two potentially opposing goals. You want to minimize the discrepancy between the observed and implied covariance matrix. In other words, we'll do everything possible to make your model fit. However, it has to respect the restrictions on the covariance matrix that are implied by the model. And it's this notion of model-imposed restrictions, which is really the heart of the matter. So let me give you an example of model-imposed restrictions. And I'm not going to talk about highfalutin, sexy models here. These are just real basic sorts of models, but they get the essential points across. And one of the reasons I'm really focusing on this stuff is very simply this. One can read books on SEM. One can take classes in SEM. And one can pay easily, drop $1,000 in a weekend for a workshop on SEM, as many of you may have. The notion of model-implied restrictions is so much the core of what's going on here, but is not emphasized enough. I know people who have been doing SEM for years who have trouble getting kind of with the concept that a model is imposing restrictions on the data. Here's a very simple mediational model with three variables, X, M standing for mediator, and Y. And the notion here is that X has an effect on Y, but it's only indirect, as mediated by its effect on M. In other words, there's no direct path from X to Y. Right? And that's really the essential feature of this model from a model fit point of view. So this model will yield equations predicting the mediator, and predicting why. And these are very simple equations. They're the kind of equations you would see in simple linear regression. However, this model does imply a restriction on the covariance. Now, let me talk about it in a standardized sense, because it's a little easier just to express those restrictions if we think about standardized variables here. But this is the restriction, that the correlation between x and y equals the product of the correlation between x and m and m and y. Right? Now, that actually makes sense if you take away that equal sign and put a negative sign in there. That is the numerator of the partial correlation between x and y partialing out m. And this model specifies that when you adjust for the effect of m, there is no relationship between x and y. Now, any implied covariance matrix that's generated from any set of data, if you look at it closely enough, that implied covariance matrix will respect this restriction. Actually, it's the top restriction of all the covariance. It's the same point. Okay? So that's the key thing about this model, and that actually is what's being tested when you assess the fit of a model. Now, factor models also impose restrictions on the data. So here is a very simple model. Actually, people would say, oh, this is a ridiculous model to test. Actually, this is an incredibly difficult model to fit. Very hard to find just one factor underlies the never found it. I even have trouble doing demos for it. So here's a model, and what are the restrictions here? Well, it turns out that there's a restriction on the implied covariance matrix here, which is the product of certain covariances have to equal each other. Okay? So the covariance between variable 1 and variable 3 has to equal times the covariance of model variable 2 and model 4 has to equal the product of the covariances of 1 and 4 and 2 and 3, which has to equal the That's the restriction. If your model fits, it'll meet that restriction. Okay. Now, this is not that foreign, because you guys have done enough statistical testing to know here that the notion that models and fit indices test model-imposed restrictions is not new. Right? It's so fundamental to certain kinds of estimation, particularly maximum likelihood estimation. The problem with SEM is that the restrictions are often invisible to the user and to consumers. And that's really the focus of what I'd like to talk about today. The main point I want to make is that there are certain issues here that are below the radar, that users are often very concerned with whether their models fit or not. But there are certain kinds of problems and ambiguities that come up with regard to the assessment of fit that you often don't see reflected in papers where SEM is used to conduct analyses. Now, this is a list of problems and ambiguities that Niels and I came up with. Actually, this is a little bit more than what we came up with. The list is constantly growing. I assume this PowerPoint will be available for people. So we're not going to talk about all these things today. I would actually like to just focus on the upper ones here, these four or five problems. So let me move to that. Issue number one is something that I think is pretty much implicit in what I've been talking about. Do you actually know what your model is testing? In other words, SEM models impose restrictions on variances and covariances. Unfortunately, researchers are often unaware of what the restrictions are. And furthermore, the restrictions actually often don't have anything to do with the reason motivating the study in a lot of cases. Furthermore, some models are so complicated that it's impossible to figure out or catalog what all the restrictions are that are being tested. So, in short, people are often unaware of what they're testing, and at the same time, what they're testing is not what they think it is in a lot of cases. So, here's a very simple model. This is kind of one of the classic sorts of SEM models. Let's say we have two variables, x and y, measured at two points in time. X at time 1, x at time 2. Y at time 1, y at time 2. Think about something like looking at the relationship between depression and anxiety. Does depression at time 1 predict anxiety at time 2? And does anxiety at time 1 predict the later onset of depression? Psychopathology literature knows that that's actually a salient question to ask, and has been asked in the SEM context. context. So typically, probably the reason you're doing the study is you're interested in what these coefficients are doing. You're particularly interested in these cross-lag coefficients. You want to know, you know, is there a significant effect of anxiety on depression without there being a significant effect of depression on anxiety? But the question is, what exactly is being tested by this model? All right? And it really should be specified in terms of covariances, but I'll just draw it and then note it up here, which is really that these residual terms, the correlation between them is zero. In other words, that the correlation or covariance between X2 and Y2 is completely accounted for by their associations with X1 and Y1. But another way, the partial correlation between X2 and Y2 adjusting for X1 and Y1 is zero. Okay? Now, the issue here is this. I am sure that when this study was designed at a research meeting, somebody didn't stand up and say, we need to test that the partial correlation between X2 and Y2 testing for X1 and Y1 is zero. That's what our model specified. That's what we're interested in. Typically, it's not what you're interested in. Okay, what about here? Well, now we just change it a little bit and we add a wave of data. Now we have three waves of data asking the same general question, and we do correlate these residuals here. And this will be a model that actually imposes four restrictions on the data. And the question is, what are those restrictions? Well, turns out that the best way to characterize what those restrictions are is just that all lag 2 effects are zero. Right? So that, in other words, you'll note that the original model, all the causal arrows are just lagged by one. Okay? So X1 has an influence on Y2, but no direct path from X1 to Y3. Okay? Similarly, even the stability of a variable is lagged one. Okay? Well, that's what this model is testing. And again, my suspicion is that's not the reason you did the study in the first place. Now, somebody might say, oh, so what you're telling me is I don't need to be concerned myself with model fit. Not an important issue. No. All right? I think it is an important issue. You wouldn't want to start interpreting a model that doesn't fit well because, number one, your coefficients are probably going to be highly biased, and actually the model as a whole may be quite wrong. The point is here is don't ignore it, but see it as a first step or perhaps a necessary condition to looking at and talking about what you're really interested in. And this is actually a salient issue if you look at published papers in SEM, which has an incredible emphasis on fit and long-winded discussions of fit, but very little analysis of the specifics of models in a lot of cases, the specific coefficients. All right. I think there's a lot of reasons for this problem, this failure to understand what exactly is being tested. Let me just talk about one of them, is that the restrictions on models are what we're saying is not there. And people, I believe, in literature and cognitive psychology would indicate, people attend much more to presence than absence, all else being equal. Well, what's being tested is what the model is saying is not going on. And furthermore, the way models are drawn, those restrictions lead to the absence of arrows. And that's really it. There's not something that typically stands out there and says zero. All right? So I think there's kind of a subtlety here, almost at an information processing level. And I actually think sometimes it's a little bit the way the model is drawn. Okay? So if I show you this model, X leads to Y leads to Z, and I say, hey, what's the restriction? What's being forbidden here? You say, I don't know. But if you draw it this way, I would argue that it just kind of screams out at you that there is not a direct path from X to Z. So in some ways, I think it actually comes down to kind of subtle graphical as other things. Okay, now the real problem is very complicated models like this guy. All right, this model is testing 62 restrictions on the data. All right, now I defy anyone to figure out what they are. All right, very complicated. What's being tested here? Now, as we'll talk about a little bit later, this is actually an important issue here, because I can tell you that the reason, I reviewed this paper for a journal, and so I can tell you that the reason the study was done was not the measurement model. It had to do with these structural paths, okay? And I can tell you that none of the restrictions for this model are imposed at the structural level. This is actually just testing the measurement restrictions. So even though you can't figure out what all those restrictions are, I mean, there's some use to be found to be able to have a sense where they're targeted in a lot of cases. Okay. Let me see. How are we doing time-wise here? Oh, okay. What is it? Okay, we're all right. Okay. Another problem that's related to this, when you focus on omnibus measures of fit, is a poorly fitting, actually that's written incorrectly there, that's a well-fitting composite model that fits, that masks an ill-fitting structural model. As I noted before, in many latent variable SEM models, it's important to distinguish between the measurement model, which specifies relationships between observable variables and latent constructs, and what we call the structural model, some people now call the path model, which is the relationships among the latent constructs. Now, when I've talked about the model to date, 95% of the time, I'm talking about what I'm now going to call the composite model, which is the whole thing, the whole model that combines both the measurement and structural components, and typically that's where your overall measures of fit are. Now, one thing to understand is that in latent variable models, the majority of the restrictions are actually imposed at the measurement level. You will note that most measurement models in SEM impose a simple structure on the data. A given variable loads on one and only one factor. That's actually something that I think is a problem in the literature, but such as it is, that introduces a very powerful set of restrictions. And typically, the number of restrictions that are imposed at the level of the structural model are much fewer. That creates a situation where the structural model can fit really poorly if analyzed in isolation, whereas the composite model fits very, very well. And this is unfortunate, given that chances are the reason the person did the study was the structural component of the model. So, as an example, again, not necessarily the most fascinating, interesting model in the world, but I'm a little bit limited in this domain. But here's a model that is just a causal chain model, very much similar to the mediational model that we saw earlier, specifying a relationship between three latent variables, X, Y, and Z. Each of these latent variables has three indicators. Okay? Now, there are restrictions here, a variety of restrictions, imposed by this model. Now, a common thing to do is to say, hey, let's just test the measurement model. Let's take any restrictions out of the structural component, and that is very conveniently done, as those of you who've done this before know, by simply correlating or specifying a covariance among all the latent variables. It turns out that if you do that, then the structural component of the model is saturated. There are as many parameters you're estimating as there are knowns in the data. And the only restrictions for the model are the measurement restrictions. And that is why this is called the literature, the measurement model. It's essentially a confirmatory factor in an analytic model that specifies covariances or correlations among a set of factors. Now, mathematically, the composite test is the global chi-square test of fit. The test of the measurement model is the chi-square test of the measurement model, as I drew it in that figure. And the test of the structural model is really a chi-square difference test. It's a nested test comparing the relative fit of the composite and measurement models. So you take it turns out that you take the difference between the chi-square for the composite model and subtract from that the composite for the measurement model, and you wind up with the specific test of the restrictions imposed by the structural model. Well, the problem here is that the majority of the restrictions in the composite model come from the measurement model. So that if you have a well-fitting measurement model, chances are the composite model is going to fit, despite the fact that the structural component may not fit well. And here here's some sample data that just results that just illustrate this point. We have a composite model that those of you who know SEM, according to the criteria commonly used, seems to fit reasonably well. And our MSEA of 0.0290 is generally considered within a range of good fit. Similarly, the chi-square test is not significant. When we test the measurement model alone, looks great. Looks great. It's a well-fitting measurement model. But when we test the single restriction that is imposed at the structural level of the model, it fits horribly, very poor fit. Okay? Now, this is a common problem in the published literature. Several years ago, McDonald and Ho wrote a psychological methods paper that really emphasized this point. We reviewed papers in a lot of different journals. Diels and I, in our paper, went through the same exercise for specifically the Journal of Abnormal Psychology, and the same thing was true. So just because a composite model fits well does not mean that the specific structural component that you're interested in will fit well. Okay, another issue is equivalent models. And this is something that that has been a real emphasis of mine over the years. And so what are equivalent models? Well, equivalent models actually occur, they're ubiquitous in statistics. Okay. Now, in this particular context, equivalent models are as such. Two models are equivalent when they're assessed fit across all possible samples of data. Hold the models constant, plug in different covariance matrices from different samples of data. The fit of the two models will always be identical, no matter what the fit index is or what the sample covariance is. Why? They impose the same restrictions on the data. And you know that restrictions are the key to model fit. So if two models impose the same restrictions, they will always be equivalent. Now, in the context of SEM, their implied covariance matrices will always be equivalent. The discrepancy index will always be equivalent. Now, here's the problem. The typical structural equation modeling that you see out there in the literature has many equivalent models, a large number of them, and at least some are actually reasonable alternatives to the researcher's model. But here's the heart of the problem. I challenge you to find an empirical SEM paper where empirical models are actually acknowledged. There is one that we've been able to find, but that was a cheater because I was the reviewer on one of them. So I don't know if we should count that. We're dealing with a desperate author. And it's amazing how simple it is to flesh this out. Okay, so here's three equivalent causal models, right? Here is the model we've been playing around with, the mediational model, X has a direct effect on Y, which has a direct effect on Z. Now, I'm sure you'll agree with me, it's a very different model in terms of what's specifying. It's the reverse pattern of causality. Z causes Y causes X. A third model is very different still. It's kind of a third variable influence model, arguing that the covariance between X and Z is really due to the fact that they have a common cause. Why? Again, a different model. Now, here's the deal. These models are all testing the same restriction. They're all equivalent models. And it is that restriction we talked about before, that the partial correlation between X and Z partialing out Y is zero. So they're all going to fit equivalently. And the fact that this is your pet model and it's done so well doesn't, in terms of it fits very well, doesn't mean that you've ruled out two other alternative models. Now, this also can be looked at through the context of measurement models. Okay? So here's a story underlying this, undoubtedly. Here's a one-factor measurement model. Four variables loading on one factor, perhaps more four variables that are indicators of depression loading on a depression factor. And my guess is it didn't fit. So one of the wonderful things about SEM is you can correlate errors of measurement, right? Which is very different from classical test theory, which measurement errors are usually assumed to be independent. And it is not uncommon in these situations to find that if you correlate measurement errors, and what does that mean? It means that X1 and X2 share something in common beyond what all four of these measures share. Perhaps they are measures of anxiety. So That's great, and you can report this as, hey, my one-factor model is basically supported. The problem is, a nice equivalent model here is this model, which is a two-factor model with no correlator. Also, this is an equivalent model, where it's now 3 and 4 that share that nice little thing in common. The point being here is that all three of these models impose the same restriction. Now, it's not a fun one to look at, and you're staring at an implied covariance matrix. I don't think it's going to come, you know, screaming out at you that this is the restriction, but that those are the facts of the matter. Now, complicated models have many, many equivalent models. So I stopped counting after a while. There are actually certain algorithms you can use to try to figure out how many equivalent models a given model draws up. I stopped counting around 34,000. So there are 34,000 equivalent models that are here that alternative ways of rendering the data that will have identical fit. Now, here's a few of them. This is the original model. This is an equivalent model that actually specifies, perhaps the key thing here, specifies instead of trait disinhibition and negative affectivity having influence on borderline, it goes the other way, which actually, to me, it's a chicken and egg problem. Were you a borderline before you were anxious? That's a question I struggle with on a daily basis. So it can go either way. Here's an equivalent model that actually you might say, now this is implausible. And it's important to note that not all equivalent models are plausible. Here you have, in essence, the outcome. The outcome is actually predicting the distal variables that occurred earlier. Now, you might say, well, that's unrealistic, but it so happens this was a cross-sectional study that was done in terms of its measurement properties. In other words, these data were collected at the same time that these data were collected, and they're based on retrospective reports. There is a literature out there that would argue that when people are anxious or they're depressed or they're borderline, they reinterpret their past at some level. So maybe this isn't implausible. And actually, one review of our paper, we wanted to present this as an implausible model. The reviewer said, hey, I think that's plausible as hell. So people may differ. Now, here's an important thing. This is also an equivalent model, and this is not an easy thing to draw, but I'll tell you what it is. It's a confirmatory factor analysis model. In other words, if you were to go back to this original model and say, I'm not interested in this causality stuff, I just think I've got factors here that I want to freely estimate and correlate. That's equivalent to this. And that's an important point, because what I've just told you then is that this model is equivalent to the measurement model. There are no restrictions being imposed by this model at the structural component of the data. Now, trust me, when this model fit, the author was thrilled and interpreted it in terms of, boy, we have a great causal model here. But actually, the causal component of the model, as opposed to the measurement, wasn't being tested at all. So, something to be aware of. Now, one of the things that I would suggest is that it's very important for researchers to acknowledge the presence of an equivalent model, and more subtly, to use experimental designs that limit the number of plausible equivalent models. So happens that one of the selling points of longitudinal research, as opposed to cross-sectional research, is that with longitudinal studies, you actually limit the number of causal of equivalent models, basically because it's hard to argue that things that you measured at time 3 cause things that you measured at time 1. Now, there's actually some subtleties to that point, so I don't want to beat it to death, but just to make the point that this is another reason for doing longitudinal research. Okay, one of the things that goes along with a real emphasis, really an overemphasis on model fit, is that users sometimes don't attend to lower order components. I've read plenty of papers and reviewed plenty of papers where the discussion of the model and the results focused on the fit, not on more specific, detailed analysis of actually the parameters of the model in terms of things like proportion of variance accounted for in dependent measures, magnitude of effects issues in general. You rarely see confidence around parameters. Now, here's the interesting thing. In most statistical procedures that you use, I mean, I mentioned that multiple regression is kind of an alternative way to do business here, at least for variables that are not latent variable models. In those procedures, what I'm calling lower order components are actually the whole ball of wax. They're the focus of things. So you will find regression coefficients being interpreted in terms of their magnitude, proportion of effect measures, specific equations. The important thing to understand here with SEM is there can be very, very strong dissociation between overall measures of model fit and what I'm calling lower order components of the model. So, as an example, let's say this is a very simple model that's being tested, okay, among these four variables. And I just made up two sample covariance matrices. Okay? So one study was done, this was the sample covariance matrix. One study was done, this was the sample covariance. We're going to test the model for both of these observed sets of data. So what do we find? Well, these are the measures of overall fit here. These are what I'm calling lower order components. Okay? Now, for those of you unfamiliar with SEM, I'm going to tell you that the model that was estimated using the covariance matrix, the first covariance matrix there, fits really well. In fact, it fits perfectly. So that model, that covariance matrix, it turns out, meets the restrictions that are imposed by the model perfectly. However, note, the path coefficients are extremely small. None of them are significant. And the proportion of variances in the dependent measures are well less than 1%. So if we go back here, what we find is that the proportion of variance in Y that's accounted for by Q and X is extremely small. And the proportion of variance in Z that's accounted for by Y is really small. The model fits perfectly. On the other hand, you have the opposite case. You have a model that, by any consensual criteria, really doesn't fit well. But you have wonderful results in the sense that you have a very high proportion of variances, highly significant coefficients. So just because a model fits well doesn't mean that what you're really interested in many cases is going to be a good news story. And it's extremely important to emphasize what I'm calling lower order components of fit as much as fit itself. Now, there's actually an interesting problem embedded in this, which is how can a model with such bad lower order components fit perfectly? And this is something, as one of those deals with SEM, you've been doing SEM for I don't know if you've ever done this, use a statistical procedure or anything else for a number of years, and then something that you've taken for granted from day one suddenly occurs to you as the reason, and a really strange feature of it. It's this. For SEM, there is a sense in which residuals, the error space, in the linear algebra sense, which is often opposed to the model space, the residuals are actually a part of the model itself. All right? Now, those of you who did multiple regression analysis would say, hey, sum of squares error, that's the enemy. That's not the model component. The model is being tested by the sum of squares regression, or the appropriate F-test. In SEM, it's a little bit more complicated than that. There's actually two types of residuals in SEM. One is the residual matrix, that is the difference between the observed and the implied covariance. Now, that's an important matrix in terms of model testing. You do not want that to be large. That suggests a substantial discrepancy. But there's also the residual variances and covariances for specific variables that are dependent variables. And they're actually model parameters. So when you look at this model here, you see these two guys, residual Y and residual Z. It's part of the model. These variances of these residuals are actually directly estimated. And for me, this is a critical reason why a model can fit perfectly and have lousy lower order components, which is residual variances can fill in the difference. Typically, residual variances are what are known as just identified parameters. So there are very few restrictions. So it will take the proportion of variance that is predicted by X and Y in Z, and then take the difference between that and the actual variance of Z, and then there's your residual variance term. So if you look at implied covariance matrices, it is very common to find that the variances of variables equal the observed variance. Right? So this is a very important point, actually, in terms of SEM as an approach to theory testing, because you know, the weird thing about SEM is, and I probably should have said this at the beginning, and we probably would have had a much smaller audience, is that most models don't fit, okay? They don't. People are in denial of that fact. But the amazing thing is, even when they do, that a lot of it is due to the ability to be bailed out by residual terms as part of the model. Now, what's a residual term in this context? It's unexplained influences that you probably haven't even bothered to think about. Because you're tired, you know? You had enough trouble thinking about the sorts of things that are in the model and measuring those things. I mean, how much can one do? And actually, residual covariances terms are often critical, too. And in SEM write-ups, you don't see this point emphasized. Turns out that this residual term, between the residual of trait disinhibition and negative affectivity for this model, is critical. As a matter of fact, if there's one path here, that's the most important single thing in this model, it's that residual covariance. Because if you specify this, if you take that residual covariance out, this model not only doesn't fit, but you get parameters that are beyond their range. You get things like negative variance. Okay? So this little covariance term is actually quite critical. And it's a covariance between residuals. I don't know what D1 and D2 are. But I'm able to benefit from a statistical procedure that allows me to estimate the covariance between those two factors. Now, there are a lot of cases in SEM, if you review the literature, in which more specific features of a model, what I'm calling these lower level features, are ignored. And there's a whole host of problems, okay, that I don't have time to go into. Uses of various different kinds of chi-square tests for parameters and that sort of thing. But here's the irony. Were you to take a lot of these models and do a traditional multiple regression analysis, you don't have those measures, overall measures that fit in SEM. You're stuck with proportional variance. Also, typically, multiple regression analysis, at least if you read the way it should be done, involves an extensive analysis of individual subjects' data in terms of outliers, distributions of residuals, that sort of thing. SEM, the analysis is typically done right off a covariance matrix. So you actually don't even need the specific data. That's why people are constantly bothering other people by reanalyzing their data. They just take the covariance matrix of some published papers. Here's the weird thing. In a lot of cases, a more rigorous analysis of a set of data is actually done by good old multiple regression analysis than by an SEM model. Okay. Let me just talk about one final thing, and that is the issue of omitted variables. Okay. Now, omitted variables is the problem. Anyways, one of the big problems in statistics. Models omit important variables. Right? So we have residual terms, among other things. Now, one of the major criticisms against structural equation modeling that was actually leveled very, very early on is this issue of omitted variables. Is that typically structural equation models omit important variables that are included in kind of the overall causal nexus here. Now, one claim that's been made is that structural equation models are not at all sensitive to omitted variables. Other people have argued, yes, they are sensitive. In other words, you'll be penalized in terms of your estimate of fit if you omit variables. Well, actually, the truth is somewhere in the middle. Sometimes you will be penalized for sometimes you won't, and it depends what the true causal structure is in relationship to the model you're testing. So once again, this little causal chain model will be what we're testing. Now, it turns out, without going into detail, assume that there's a fourth variable out there, Q, which has been omitted from your model. This is the correct alternative structure of the data. Here's an alternative correct alternative structure of the data. In other words, reality. Reality 1, reality 2. Here, Q is also implicated, but the relationship between Q, X, Y, and Z is a little bit different. Q has a direct effect on Y, no direct effect on Z. All right? Now, you're testing this model in your ignorance, and you've omitted Q. Well, it turns out that in this case, you will be penalized in terms of fit. Now, obviously, this is dependent on sampling error and power. Let's just say we're analyzing the population covariance matrices here. Let's take sampling issues out of the equation. If this is the true model and you're testing this one, it turns out it won't fit. However, if this is the correct model and you're testing this one, it will fit perfectly. So there's a technical explanation of that I will not bother you with, but you can actually figure out when you'll be bitten by omitted variables and when you will not. So the truth is somewhere in between. The important point here is that a well-fitting model could and almost always does omit important variables. Now, this is an important thing to think about, because as I just mentioned a while back, SEM models have this possibility, it's residual terms. You have residual variances and residual covariances. And the question is, can residual variances and covariances, which really represent omitted influences, can they balance out here? In other words, even if a model omits important predictors, the ability to specify omitted things in the model, can it help us? And the answer is generally not, although it depends what you're really concerned about. Number one, without going into technical detail, there are limits on the types of relationships that residual terms can have in SEM models in terms of rendering the model suddenly untestable. So that's number one. But the interesting thing is, and this is consistent with today's talk, you can use residual variance and covariances terms to make a model that didn't fit initially fit well, and not at all solve the problem of biased estimates of coefficients. And it's the problem of bias that is the classic problem of omitted variables. In other words, you have a regression equation with two predictors, and there's another third predictor out there, or fourth predictor, that is correlated with the predictors already in the model. By omitting those third and fourth variables, what happens? Well, you get biased estimates of the coefficients for variable 1 and variable 2, a well-known problem. So here's an example, okay? Let's say you have this as your model, where you have three distal influences of y1 and y2. And this model specifies, pretty simple, it specifies that x1, x2, and x3 are all correlated with each other and all have direct effects on both y1 and y2. All right? Now, these numbers here are the actual true causal coefficients. You say, how do I know that? I can do that. I'm giving the talk. Okay? Here I'm omniscient, in a sense. I'm creating a hypothetical population situation. So here's our coefficients, and I've drawn in red the coefficients indicating, these consider them regression coefficients, indicating the effects of x3 on y1 and y2. So I forget about, well, I don't forget, I don't know about x3. I'm doing the best I can. So I test a model that has x1 and x2 as predictors of y1 and y2. In all other respects, the model's identical. Bad news, doesn't fit. So this is one of those cases where I'm getting burned for omitting x3. But I realize I have the ability to represent a covariance between the residuals of d1 and d2. And if you do that, you know, you could almost stick a third variable here, and that would actually have the same effect as omitting the covariance between d1 and d2. So, being the smart structural equation modeler that I am, I specify a covariance term between d1 and d2. And wonderfully, the model fits perfectly. As a matter of fact, it better fit perfectly. It's what's known as a saturated model. All right? Here's the important point. You have not affected the estimates at all. All right? These estimates, going back to the original model, should be 0.2. We tested the model without x3. The coefficients are 0.37. That's off. That's not 0.2. We generate a model that fits perfectly by correlating the residuals. We have not touched the bias at all. As a matter of fact, those coefficients have remained unchanged. So you've got a wonderful thing. You've created a model that now fits that you're going to interpret with biased coefficients. One might argue you might have been better off stopping at the point in time when the model didn't fit, because now you're going to report something that is more likely to be erroneous. So here's another example of how there's a dissociation between the issue of model fit and other features of a model. You can do things to make a model fit, but not necessarily mean your estimates are going to get any better. Okay, so to summarize, in structural equation modeling, I really probably haven't sold it enough. Okay, it's a very powerful and comprehensive data analytic technique. However, there are a number of issues regarding model fit and its assessment that typically operate under the radar of researchers. And let me point out one thing, is that if you look at the methodological literature in SEM, sorts of things that get people promoted, they get them tenure among quantitative psychologists, the overwhelming majority of papers are on the assessment of fit, comparing different fit measures, their properties, that sort of thing. Users are typically pretty up on that kind of stuff. As a matter of fact, I'm amazed at people's ability to understand the latest results concerning fit measure X. These problems, however, have not actually been the focus of the methodological literature on SEM. And they're also not the focus of things like introductory textbooks on SEM, workshops, that sort of thing. So I think these are the sorts of things that we really need to come to an understanding about and to emphasize